Law and Grace, Chapter 7. Not without blood. The foundation principle of expiation. The law's teaching methods. We now resume our study of the specifically allegorical features of the law after our necessary survey of its great moral precepts. We find the sacrificial laws making first an urgent claim upon our attention. This they do not merely because they are in any case bulking so large, but also because already at several points we've had reason to note how great is their importance in the whole scheme of the law. Yet, seeing that they are couched so very much in its characteristic idiom, it is as well that we have deferred our examination until such time as we have become fairly familiar with that idiom. Before proceeding further, therefore, we shall first take stock of our findings so far. We can recapitulate as follows. Firstly, the use of things physical as emblems of things spiritual can justly be called the raw material of the law. Its importance is by now much too obvious to need stressing, as we are only too well aware. Our basic problem throughout this study is that of deciding correctly what the proper counterpart is of each of the carnal ordinances which the law employed as teaching devices. Secondly, we have acquired a valuable familiarity with the law's use of a process of sample selection, to which for convenience we have given the name the principle of representation. We have, for example, seen a doorway standing for a whole house, one tribe, but even one man for an entire race, one nation for all nations. The successful interpretation of the symbolism frequently depends on our recognizing this principle when it operates. Thirdly, we have also seen the law arrange its symbolism according to a graduated scale, contriving thereby to teach the same essential lesson in successively more emphatic forms. This was especially obvious in the case of our study of Israel as a priestly people. As we moved inwards from the outer fringes of the camp to the inner sanctuary within the veil, the symbolism steadily increased in intensity, producing an effect comparable to that of a crescendo movement in music. Fourthly, in addition, certain theme studies are already beginning to emerge in clear outline and to impose a topical unity on what at first sight seem to be unrelated symbols. We've heard the law telling us with the same compelling insistence as that with which it spoke to Israel that fellowship with God must not be marred by moral corruption, that membership of the covenant people entails total self-consecration to God's service, that the destiny of the Israel of God is to be a holy nation, enjoying free access to God in his ineffable purity and holiness, and above all, that atonement alone makes fellowship with God a possibility in the first place. The latter is the great theme which we must now proceed to develop. The antecedents of the law. The sacrificial laws could not bring their great lessons home to any save those who were predisposed to heed them by a mood of deep contrition. They had no appeal except for the chastened and penitent in spirit. And for this, the law made due provision. As we shall very quickly discover, the regulations governing ceremonial uncleanness were designed to serve as a perfect foil to the sacrificial laws. So true is this that a prior study of the first can correctly be said to be indispensable to the successful interpretation of the other. On the other hand, no study of the uncleanness regulations can proceed far without it becoming obvious that they, in their turn, would have been largely meaningless had their lessons been novel to the law itself and unrelated to earlier revelation. In fact, in the case both of the legislation for uncleanness and of that for sacrifice alike, the law had necessarily to build on foundations laid much earlier in human history, if its message was to be at all relevant or intelligible. In this connection, a truism stated once already in this study bears repeating, namely, that the law was delivered at a definite stage in time and under special circumstances. This meant that no Israelite present at Sinai could doubt the fact of his deliverance from bondage in Egypt or dispute its miraculous nature. As for the reason for it all, the law simply assumed that he had no need to be told it. What Moses did was not to inform the people of something new, but merely stir up their minds by way of remembrance when he stated, "Because the Lord loved you and because he would keep the oath which he had sworn unto your fathers, hath the Lord brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you out of the house of bondmen from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt." Familiarity with that oath on the part of the Israelites was presupposed in the very terms of Moses' commission. "Thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, the Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob hath sent me unto you." Devout Israelitish parents would consider it a duty to nurture their children in the patriarchal hope, for had not Abraham set them all an example? Of him the angel had testified, "I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment." It was such fidelity on Jochebed's part which alone ensured that Moses, having come to years, would refuse to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. Moses supposed that his brethren would have understood how that God by his hand would deliver them, but they understood not. Their thoughts, it would seem, were preoccupied with things other than God's promise of deliverance, and faithful Jochebed was probably the exception rather than the rule among Israelitish mothers in those dark days. Yet she, and other men and women like her, did God's work by preserving from generation to generation the knowledge of the promises to Abraham, and not only spoke of the promises, but also of Abraham's call and of all that bespoke the dividing of the nations. Before that, the flood, backwards eventually to the events of creation, with their tragic sequel in the sin of Adam, the father of us all. From the very beginning, the whole atmosphere of Israelitish education was essentially religious. Characteristic of all the pious in Israel was the psalmist who wrote, "I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known, and our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children," showing to the generation to come the praises of the Lord and his strength and his wonderful works that he hath done, that they might set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments. In every devout Israelitish household, therefore, the early stories of the Bible must have made up the greater part of the family's fund of knowledge, and the conclusion seems inescapable that they actually assumed literary form at a very early stage. So precious was the light they cast on the dealings of God with man. At all events, we are surely on safe ground in asserting that the historical facts themselves, as summarized for us so conveniently in the book of Genesis, were common knowledge to the generation which God led forth from Egypt, and that for these men and women there was a significant continuity between his doings in the past and in the present. That continuity is everywhere reflected in the law. It incorporated not a few institutions which were much older than itself, for example, burnt offering, peace offering, and the distinction between meats clean and unclean, found in Genesis 7 and Exodus 20. The significant thing about circumcision, as the Lord so pointedly reminded the Jews, was that the law, while insisting upon it, did so not because it is of Moses, but of the fathers. John 7, verse 22. The law was essentially in the nature of an addition to matters which existed long before it. In almost every respect, what it had to say through its symbolism was not something original, but merely a reiteration and elaboration of earlier revelation. It built, in fact, upon the Genesis story and presupposed acquaintance with it, serving only like a magnifying glass to enlarge what was there already in microscopic form. As we proceed with our study, we shall come more and more to realize that the whole of the ritual of the law ultimately derived its relevance from the tale of Eden. And particularly will this prove to be so, as we have said, in the case of both of the uncleanness laws and of the sacrificial regulations which were their complement, with each of which we now proceed to deal in turn. God's altar was not to be profaned by the sight of human nakedness. Linen breeches had to be made for the priests, types of the nation as a whole, let us not forget, to cover their nakedness. The directions were explicit: from the loins even unto the thighs they shall reach, and they shall be upon Aaron and upon his sons when they come near unto the altar to minister in the holy place, that they bear not iniquity and die. It shall be a statute for ever unto him and his seed after him. Who could miss the echo here of Genesis? The record stood of Eve, that she took of the fruit and did eat, and gave also unto her husband with her, and he did eat. Instantaneously they were conscious in themselves of the effects of their wrongdoing, and the eyes of them both were opened, and they knew that they were naked. Where before they had been naked and yet at the same time rightly free of any sense of shame, they had now become sensible that their physical state reflected their fallen spiritual condition. So the concealment of the shame of their nakedness, particularly from God, became their first concern. Covering was indeed necessary, and ineffectual though their self-covering was, it yet possessed a becoming propriety in that it signified acknowledgement on their part that man could no longer hold converse with God unless first his shame were hid. Clearly, it was in order to throw that great fact into relief that the law was so emphatic on the matter of nakedness, from the loins even unto the thighs they shall reach, that they bear not iniquity and die. The altar manifestly stood for God. The priest's nakedness, with equal obviousness, stood for sin. Between the two, linen breeches, i.e. a covering of righteousness, had first to be interposed before approach by them was possible. Nakedness, as a symbol of sin, was thus appropriated by the law from Genesis. And with what far-reaching consequences! For are not all, without exception, born naked? Or as the law would, by implication, have us construe it, are not all, without exception, born in sin? The law's own answer to that question was emphatic, and this again derived all its relevance from the judgment passed in Eden on Adam's sin. No conception in the first place was possible without the contraction by both male and female of ceremonial uncleanness. What could this mean other than that human life, for the race and for the individual alike, had been vitiated by the taint of sin at its very source? In keeping with this, when conception at last issued in birth, and God's stern words to Eve, the mother of all living, took full effect, the initial uncleanness was intensified sevenfold or fourteenfold, and needed after further lapse of time to be cleansed by atoning sacrifice. Such regulations made the connotation of the term uncleanness, as used in the law, transparently clear. Like nakedness, it typified a state of sin, with the slight difference, perhaps, that it laid even greater emphasis upon the fact that sin interrupted fellowship with God. Of the mother of the newborn child, it was decreed, she shall touch no hallowed thing, nor come into the sanctuary until the days of her purifying be fulfilled. So also was it to be in the case of a priest defiled by some uncleanness. There was to be no contact whatever with the holy things. As by now we might expect, the law dealt likewise with disease and death. These too became causes of defilement. What could this mean but that the law intended each Israelite to see in them also further significant reminders of the havoc wrought by Adam's fatal first offence? For surely, in making them means of contracting ceremonial uncleanness, it most pointedly related them both to sin. Consequently, on the Day of Atonement, both the uncleanness of the children of Israel and their transgressions in all their sins equally necessitated the making of atonement for the holy place. One was merely emblematic of the other. The physical was once again the sign and symbol of the spiritual and the moral. For this reason, it also served very appropriately as a type of the alienation from God, which is inseparable from uncleanness on the moral plane. That is, uncleanness stood both for acts of sin and for the separation from God which they inevitably entailed. Conversely, cleanness presupposed a state of near relationship to God and also bestowed that holiness of conduct which was alone compatible with it. Nowhere was this double-sidedness of cleanness and uncleanness more apparent than in the food laws. Dividing animal flesh into two categories, clean and unclean, these reflected and typified the twofold division of the human family which was involved in God's choice of Israel. I am the Lord your God which hath separated you from other people. You shall therefore put difference between clean beasts and unclean, and between unclean fowls and clean. So much for the status of Israel before God, but this brought the obligation to manifest holiness with it. So there was added in proof of the fact, and ye shall be holy unto me, for I the Lord am holy, and have severed you from other people, that ye should be mine. Throughout the law, these twin notions complemented one another and gave relevance to all its enactments concerning ceremonial defilement and its removal. But the key to the understanding of the uncleanness regulations now in our possession, we must proceed forthwith to familiarize ourselves completely with them before we actually attend to the sacrificial laws to which they served to turn the gaze of the pious and reflective Israelite, the way in which they induced in him the consciousness of sin is truly fascinating to observe. We will begin with a very simple example. Chance contact with the carcass of an unclean animal brought defilement, which lapsed automatically and without further ado at even. Now, the fact that the uncleanness thus acquired was relatively slight and of but brief duration did not alter the fact that it was still uncleanness, and as such an emblem and reflection of his sinfulness to the person so affected. It was futile for him to plead that he was actually, in this instance, not guilty of any moral offence. The law pronounced him unclean, and that was that. And until a new day began at sundown and a fresh beginning could be made, he had perforce to submit to the judgment of the law. His liberties were circumscribed. Approach the sanctuary or touch any holy thing, he dare not. The import of this was clear. Sin cuts man off from God. That was the first and simplest lesson. Contact with the unclean animal's carcass could, however, be more than merely slight and accidental. The law made appropriate allowance for this fact also. The regulation was, whosoever toucheth the carcass of them shall be unclean until the even, and whosoever beareth aught of the carcass of them shall wash his clothes and be unclean until the even. The distinction could not be missed. Carrying the carcass entailed a graver uncleanness than merely touching it. That same distinction was drawn also in the case of the carcass of an animal that was in the category clean. If any beast of which ye may eat die, he that toucheth the carcass shall be unclean until the even, and he that eateth of the carcass of it shall wash his clothes and be unclean until the even. He also that beareth the carcass of it shall wash his clothes and be unclean until the even. The parallelism between the two regulations is self-evident. They legislate for contact with the carcasses of totally different animals. On that account also, the second of the two, being like everything else, part of a rational system, legislated, in addition, for the eating of the flesh, whereas the other, for the same reason, did not, and of course ought to have no need to do so. Even so, when due allowance has been made for both these differences, they merely serve to emphasize the essential similarities between these laws. The distinction between merely touching and actually carrying or eating the carcass, that was the operative factor in each case. It was that which was the secret of the moral lesson to be taught. What then was the difference between the two, between touching and carrying? It was the difference between a slight, temporary, possibly accidental contact on the one hand and an intimate, sustained, and essentially voluntary contact on the other. And so we find that it was the difference in the degree of contact which determined the difference in the degree of uncleanness contracted in each case. And the significant thing was that in the case of the second form of defilement, in both regulations, it was definitely the responsibility of the person concerned as to whether he did or did not contract it. Touching the carcass would in many cases be involuntary, but carrying it, the same went for eating it, could not, in the nature of things be other than deliberate? So first, the moral was that deliberate contact with a source of defilement was a much more serious matter than a chance, casual, or unavoidable contact with it. That is, that conscious sin is a far graver thing than sin which is unwitting or which springs from weakness. And to emphasize the moral, the man who of his own will involved himself in this more serious contact with defilement was required to engage in a second compensating and equally deliberate act of ritual cleansing, the washing of his clothes. Woe betide him if he belittled the moral import of the distinction here drawn by the law. It was, technically speaking, the law which had involved him in defilement. It was therefore the law alone which could prescribe how he was to secure release from it. As with a related regulation, so here the rule would be, if he washed them not, then he shall bear his iniquity. It's in Leviticus 17. Those were ominous words. They made explicit that connection between physical uncleanness and moral sinfulness, which was the rationale of the uncleanness laws. They signified that neglect on the man's part to avail himself of the means provided of ridding himself of uncleanness was tantamount to a willful persistence in sin and defiance of God. Accordingly, if later he relented, he found that the simple washing of his clothes initially prescribed was no longer adequate, but that, in keeping with a much greater degree of guilt which by now he had incurred, a sin offering had become necessary for his cleansing. How exquisitely consistent did the law prove to be in all these details? But while that fact by now needs no further labouring, there's still one matter which we have neglected to examine. What was it that formed the actual nexus in these regulations between ceremonial defilement and actual transgressions? We have but to recall the source of defilement to receive the answer. In the one regulation, the animal was clean, and in the other, unclean, but such a distinction was overshadowed in each case by a far more serious factor. The flesh was in each case dead. Death it was that caused the defilement. Death. The act working of a physical principle of dissolution and decay, which perfectly mirrors that process of moral corruption which has been at work in man ever since Adam's fall. We see then again how meaningless the uncleanness laws, for these two are typical of them all, would have been to the Israelites had they not been familiar with the tale of Eden. On the other hand, how eloquently they spoke to those who, for the very reason that they had taken the lessons of Eden to heart, had ears to hear. Now, the kinds of defilements which we have just examined were peculiar in that every Israelite, do what he might, would inevitably contract one form or other of them with fair frequency. The law clearly arranged for this deliberately, for we can see that the very ease and frequency with which a man contracted such, relatively speaking, less serious forms of uncleanness would compel him most effectively to recognize how real was his sinfulness, however unconscious he normally was of the fact, or however reluctant he was to acknowledge it. Yet in all this, the law, though stern and uncompromising, was not inhumane. It compensated for the frequency with which such defilement was contracted by arranging that it would normally be of brief duration only, and that ordinary water should suffice for the cleansing ritual. By this means, the law struck a fair balance, contriving to impart spiritual tuition without causing in the process an intolerable and too vexatious and inconvenient an interruption of the daily round of the ordinary Israelite. It merely interfered with his normal routine with sufficient awkwardness to ensure that he would not fail to become conscious of the sad fact that he was a sinner in dire need of forgiveness. Herein, however, lay an element of risk. The regularity with which the law, through its ritual, thus spoke to men, while it was indeed a most effective means of educating their conscience, was nevertheless dangerous in that it might also, in course of time, through sheer repetition, numb their conscience and make it insensitive to sin, adding to which some might in any case come to regard water as in itself efficacious to remove sin. It was precisely here that once again the climactic structure of the symbolism proved so valuable a device. The law obviated all such error and misunderstanding by legislating for serious as well as for less serious forms of defilement, and selecting for that purpose less common and more moving events, such as a birth or bereavement or the contraction of some chronic malady, which made it the occasion for further and far more significant prescriptions of uncleanness. These were obviously designed to serve as rarer and more arresting reminders of the gravity of the defilement caused in sin by in man by sin, and were conveniently useful for that purpose, because they in any case of themselves interfered very considerably with the daily routine of the persons involved. The law was therefore free to impose cleansing regulations in connection with them of far greater stringency in order to match the much greater degree of uncleanness which it in each case declared to exist. Regulations of immeasurably greater significance because blood sacrifice was expressly declared to be indispensable to the cleansing process. But why first did the law declare a much greater degree of uncleanness to exist in these particular cases? Why did it make choice of them rather than of others, we might ask? The answer is of crucial importance, and the recollection that the symbolism of the law had a rational, consistent basis really frames it for us. It's clearly because these cases had much more than a mere usefulness from a practical point of view that they were chosen. Their real value lay in their intrinsic fitness to serve as ritual symbols of sin. Sin it was, we must remember, which was the great theme of the uncleanness laws at every stage. Therefore, none of these causes of defilement could have qualified to serve as a teaching device unless it had some radical connection with sin itself. And this connection lay in the fact, indeed, must have lain in the fact, that each was itself in some way an effect of sin, and so in itself apt as a symbol of sin. That is, implicit in the law's very choice of certain things to serve as causes of uncleanness was the recognition of the fact that these things themselves were ultimately attributable to sin. Each was, in effect, the symptom of a congenital malady and just one sample of the physical results of Adam's transgression. At this point, one further feature common to all the uncleanness laws assumes its full significance. Defilement was contracted by contact with the cause of uncleanness. The emphasis throughout was on touching, so much so that a person defiled by contact with the original cause of uncleanness could in turn transmit his defilement to other things which came into contact with him. If then, in the ultimate sense, the cause of defilement stood for Adam's sin, what was each Israelite to do but see in himself an extension of Adam, and in each sin he committed, a reenactment of the first transgression? And having come to that point, what could he conclude but that he too, like Adam, was under, and righteously under, the sentence of death? This notion of the solidarity of the human race is the unifying factor in all the uncleanness laws and is the secret of the form which the more serious of them took. To begin with, apart from leprosy, all the diseases of which they took account were diseases of the reproductive organs. Even the normal menstrual flow in healthy women bore close enough an affinity to the idea of the defilement caused by ancestral sin to be classed as a cause of 7 days' uncleanness. This in itself was pointed enough an indication of the hereditary effect of Eve's and Adam's sin. How much more pointed was it when the prolongation of this flow beyond the normal spell was pronounced to be a cause of the gravest kind of uncleanness? The emphasis now, an emphasis essential to the allegory, was on the fact that the female reproductive organs were diseased. So too with man. Disease in the male reproductive system was equally defiling, hidden away out of sight, though the source of defilement might have been, yet its existence could not be denied. In man and in woman alike, the same fatal symptoms bore witness to it. When any man hath a running issue out of his flesh because of his issue, he is unclean. And if a woman have an issue of her blood many days out of the time of her separation, she shall be unclean. In each case, the operative factor was the same. It was an issue that was the cause of defilement. An issue, moreover, out of the flesh. Flesh tainted by sin. More transparent symbolism we could not hope to find. The fact was that some source of corruption within the flesh, some deep-seated physical disease of the very springs of life, was exuding noisome matter. How could its allegorical meaning possibly be missed? Human nature had clearly been marred at the source. For man and for woman alike, the counterpart of the inward malady was inbred sin. This moral malady, like the physical, secreted a defiling issue. In this case, sinful thoughts and words and deeds. The law was here saying as plainly as ever it could that that which cometh out of the man, that defileth the man, for from within, out of the heart of men, proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lasciviousness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within and defile the man. Once again, we note the nexus between the ceremonial and the moral aspects of uncleanness was the fact that ultimately all forms of disease are attributable to sin. It's on that same account that the Lord, healer of physical and moral ills alike, on the one hand said to a paralyzed man, "Son, be of good cheer, thy sins be forgiven thee," and on the other spoke of sinners as those who needed a physician. The medical metaphor sprang naturally to his mind from the prophets, for example, Hosea 6. The allegory of these uncleanness regulations was exhaustive in its details, as it catered in the law of issues for the idea of sin in action, so in others it allowed for the idea of sin outworking itself in death. Inasmuch as death is but sin come to full fruition, it was inevitable that contact with it should be declared a cause of ceremonial uncleanness. The lesson that the wages of sin is death was seen earlier to be obvious enough, even in the legislation affecting contact with the carcass of an animal. How much more obvious yet was it in the case of contact with dead human flesh, with the flesh which is properly the sphere of sin's operation. In such cases, the symbolism was of incomparably greater meaning. As a bridge between the two sets of regulations, between the ideas represented by the law of issues and those represented by the law of defilement through contact with dead bodies, came the additional laws affecting leprosy. Here, the lesson that sin issues inevitably in death reached its intensest pitch. Such was the wretched leper's affliction that his body decomposed visibly while he still lived. He was as one dead of whom the flesh is half consumed when he cometh out of his mother's womb. Once again, the symbolism was transparent. The corrupting condition of the flesh was a parable of the corroding effects of sin, patent for all to see. While the mortification of limb after limb typified death as the end to which sin inexorably leads, the dual parable taught plainly that corruption on the physical plane is but the image and the outcome of corruption on the moral plane. The converse also being true in the final reckoning. The divine plan was therefore both comprehensive and inexorable. Command the children of Israel that they put out of the camp every leper and everyone that hath an issue, and whosoever is defiled by the dead. Such a ban was calculated to make every devout man and woman in Israel realize how utterly sin separates man from God. For to what did the exclusion of such people from the camp correspond, if not to Adam's expulsion from the garden? It made clear to all still left in the camp that the obligation devolving upon them as residents there was nothing less than that of manifesting perfect sinlessness. Yet none could in practice achieve it. No matter. They were expected nevertheless to give ritual assent that such was indeed their duty by punctilious conformity to the ceremonial laws, and thus shall ye separate the children of Israel from their uncleanness, that they die not in their uncleanness when they defile my tabernacle that is among them. That they die not in their uncleanness. How significant was that caution? How close it revealed the connection between sin and death to be. Persuading the Israelite on the one hand that there is none righteous, no, not one. What could the uncleanness regulations teach him on the other, but that by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. Thus, through fear of death, the Israelite was, in one sense, all his lifetime subject to bondage. There was not an Israelite at Horeb who did not know what bondage was, for there was not one among them either who had not been delivered from it. How had their liberation been accomplished? The events of one unforgettable night gave them the answer. The Passover lamb had been slain. His blood had been daubed on signposts and lintel, and then the angel of death had gone forth to do his dread work. But God had said, "The blood shall be to you for a token upon the houses where ye are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you. And the plague shall not be upon you to destroy you when I smite the land of Egypt. And this day shall be unto you for a memorial." For a memorial was what God had said. That meant then that an eternal principle was involved. Life had been spared. "I will pass over you, and the plague shall not be upon you to destroy you." Yes, life had been spared, all right, but at what a cost? "When I see the blood, I will pass over you." That is, life had been surrendered in order that life might be delivered. A paradox, truly, but one of momentous significance for every reflective Israelite. It was in the light of that fact that the prescription of blood sacrifice in connection with the cleansing of the more serious forms of uncleanness assumed its full significance. "The blood shall be to you for a token," was what God had said. That is, the blood had no efficacy in itself as blood pure and simple, but only as a token of something else. Of what? Physiological facts are that blood is that which most distinguishes animal from vegetable life, flesh from the green herb. Through it, the life courses. Without it, life ceases. So, by simple metonymy, it can be justly substituted in many cases for the term life itself. Murder is often spoken of as bloodshed, and this is done with propriety, simply because blood is so apt and vivid a symbol of life, even in cases where a lethal blow or strangulation is the method of killing employed, and in the literal sense, no blood is shed at all. It was in the symbolic sense that the law so often spoke of blood, and once again, its terminology in this respect was much older than itself. When God first authorized the eating by man of animal flesh, he made the occasion one for reminding man that all life originated in him as the eternal creator. "Every moving thing that liveth shall be meat for you, even as the green herb have I given you all things, but flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, shall ye not eat." How telling a reminder was this to man? He needed the animal, its flesh, for the sustenance of his own life, that is, to keep himself alive, but paradoxically, he had to procure the animal's flesh first through depriving the animal of its life. And God gave his assent to this, but in doing so, he demanded on the part of man a ritual acknowledgement that the right which he henceforth enjoyed was one which had been delegated to him by the giver of all life himself, not one to which he had some actual title. This was arranged for, firstly, by God's action in defining the blood to be the life, and secondly, by man's action in draining all blood out of the flesh before he used the flesh for the sustenance of his own life. "Flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, shall ye not eat." Thus God spoke. Thus he declared the prerogative of taking life to be ultimately and essentially his alone. And as later in the law, that one basic lesson was here too taught in successively more emphatic forms. To the sanction of flesh-eating were conjoined other significant laws, drawing a careful distinction between the life of the beast and the life of man as the crown of God's creative work. "And surely, your blood of your lives will I require it, and the hand of every beast will I require it." As an object lesson, the killing of a man by an animal was to be avenged by the death of that animal. and as for animal, so for man. And at the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of man. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God made he man. As a foil to that stern warning, there followed a reminder to Noah and his sons that their duty, far from being that of destroying life, was on the contrary that of preserving and perpetuating it. And you, be fruitful and multiply, bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply therein. These laws, with their symbolic use of blood, were thus part of Israel's heritage when the Passover was first observed in Egypt. Not one among them would therefore fail to see the meaning of those simple words, "The blood shall be to you for a token." Where that blood was not to be seen, there the angel of death laid his hand. Only where it had been placed on sideposts and lintel did God's hovering presence divert him from the house, and life was spared. Yes, spared, but only at the cost of the life of the sacrificial lamb. That was the great principle implicit in their redemption, which they were never to forget. Hence the law: this day shall be unto you for a memorial. Blood, therefore, stood for life, and the shedding of blood for the taking of life. But the shedding of blood in sacrifice amounted to much more than a routine confession that the prerogative of taking life was solely God's. Passover alone made that clear, if only by implication. The sacrificial laws, however, went further. They made it explicit and plain beyond all dispute. Whatsoever man there be of the house of Israel, or of the strangers that sojourn among you, that eateth any manner of blood, I will even set my face against that soul that eateth blood, and I will cut him off from among his people. For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you upon the altar to make an atonement for your souls, for it is the blood that maketh an atonement for the soul. The Revised Version brings out the sense more clearly. I have given it to you upon the altar to make atonement for your souls, for it is the blood that maketh atonement by reason of the life. So vitally important is this passage that we must be at pains to understand it properly. Let us submit it, therefore, to a careful, detailed examination. We notice, first of all, that the whole relevance of the notion of atonement by blood, which it expressed, lay in the fitness of blood to act as a symbol of life. For the life of the flesh is in the blood. Not only of life as such, but more especially of life as surrendered in sacrificial death. It is the blood that maketh atonement by reason of the life. Secondly, on the one hand, the blood as blood was shown to possess no intrinsic atoning power. Such power was communicated to it solely by decree of God. I have given it to you to make atonement for your souls. But on the other hand, that pronouncement having once been made, the atoning power imputed to the blood was on that very account an actual and very real power. God meant what he said when he declared, "It is the blood that maketh atonement." Thirdly, the atoning efficacy of the blood, though real, could not become active except by relation to the altar. I've given it to you upon the altar to make atonement for your souls. Pouring out of animal blood upon the ground after slaughter certainly had a didactic value, but it had no atoning value. When the blood was brought into relation with the altar, however, matters were altogether different. Such an act was of truly momentous significance. It was an admission that communion with the altar was impossible for the sinful offerer, except on the basis of prior ritual confession that his sinfulness disqualified him from all right of access to God Most Holy, whose presence the altar symbolized. The slaying by his own hands of his offering, essential to the procurement of its blood, was a ritual sent by the offerer that sin deserved death. An avowal that he, being a sinner, was justly under sentence of death, a recognition that he could expect God to forgive him his sin not by waving his sentence upon it, but only on the basis of the vindication of that sentence. And as the ritual of the red heifer so decisively proved, only death could avail to remove death. It was by its insistence upon the immutability of God's sentence against sin that the law completed the parallel between itself and the transactions in Eden. Adam and Eve, knowing that they were naked, sewed fig leaves together and made themselves aprons. Their action was indeed symptomatic of an earnest desire on their part that their sin should be hid. It equally betrayed a failure by them to realize that God could not go back on his word while still remaining true to himself. Death was the punishment threatened for sin. Death was therefore the inexorable penalty for their offense and an essential element in any process by which their sin might actually be hid from God's pure sight. This God himself made plain to them by substituting for their ineffectual self-made clothing coats of skins of his own providing. His action in providing them was proof that he, for his part, willed not that any sinner should perish, but it made equally plain that he could not forgive sin until his intolerance of it had first expressed itself to the uttermost, and this it did ritually through the slaughter of the animals for the procurement of their skins. Thus, in a simple but telling way, the nakedness of Adam and Eve was covered, and a righteousness which they in no way merited was thereby imputed to them, but without any dereliction of God's law or compromise of his holiness or sovereignty. And the law reiterated that same great lesson and availed itself of every means of bringing home to the Israelite that expiation was his first and greatest need. By a comprehensive and carefully graduated scale of ritual ordinances in which the notions of uncleanness and of cleansing complemented one another, he was educated in the fundamental facts governing his relationship to God and made to see that no forgiveness of his sin was possible apart from a perfect sacrifice in which God's demand, that is sinlessness, and sin's demand, that is death, were simultaneously met. That is, to express the same truth in literal, not metaphorical terms, the law taught that God's insistence on holiness had ritually to be confessed as righteous by the sinner who outraged it, first in a positive way by the use of an unblemished offering to typify the perfect sinlessness which God required, secondly in a negative way by confessing in the pouring out of the animal's blood upon the altar, that death was the just desert of any who failed to manifest that sinlessness. Such ritual confession was implicit in every sacrifice whose blood came into relation with the altar. The sin offering, trespass offering, peace offering, burnt offering, all alike, despite their differences in purpose and meaning, had this in common that they each declared expiation for sin to be the first and fundamental need of him who made the offering. The law, for its own special reasons, which will become obvious later, declared such confession to be efficacious as a means of atonement, and once again gave Israel an ideal at which to aim, while making every necessary provision for the stern reality of their failure to attain it.